Welcome to this episode of On the Case, the LSE Law Society's podcast. I'm your host, Anson. Without further ado, sit back and enjoy the show.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of LSE's On the Case. Today, we are extremely lucky to have Mr. Jeffrey Young with us. Mr. Young is currently a barrister practicing at Dennis Chang's Chamber, a leading chamber in Hong Kong, and has worked on Infingernic versus Hong Kong Housing Authority 2020, a landmark case which ruled that it was unlawful for the Hong Kong Housing Authority to preclude same-sex married couples from applying for public rental housing as a family. To clarify, public rental housing is one of the many forms of public housing in Hong Kong, but for the sake of simplicity, it is the only one we will be mentioning today. First of all, thank you so much for coming on the show today, Mr. Young.
Hello, thank you for inviting me.
So you boast an incredible resume. Can you tell us a bit more about your current practice?
So basically, my practice as a barrister, I mainly specialize in public law or cases basically with public law dimensions. So that would include, for example, applications for judicial review. That would also include sometimes civil and criminal cases which involve public law or constitutional rights arguments. And that's my main area. In addition to that, basically, I also just do general civil and commercial litigation as well.
As a barrister with a specific focus or interest in public law, what stoked your interest in public law and why do you deal with LGBTQ plus issues in Hong Kong?
I've been interested in public law since I was a student, and part of it is just an intellectual interest. I'm just attracted to this more than, for example, contract or tort. I just find public law and constitutional administrative law more interesting and also more connected to things and events that are happening around us. And I guess for someone who's somewhat socially conscious, there are often issues or social issues, especially in Hong Kong, which often ends up in courts. And that was quite an interesting phenomenon. In like public law cases, although you don't always win a lot of cases, but when you do, sometimes it does create changes which extend beyond the immediate litigant. It can change laws, it can change policies, and that kind of impact, although it is not even a main reason, but it is quite a motivation as well.
In that case, before moving on to discussing the impending implementation of civil partnerships for same-sex couples, what was your motivation for taking on Infingernic versus Hong Kong Housing Authority 2020?
There's not much motivation for taking the case on because as a barrister, basically, cases come to you. You're not the one who's actively seeking out the case. I'm interested in quality law. I'm interested in public law. And I have a particular interest in sort of developing this practice. And this was obviously a very good case. I also have personal convictions and I believe in the cause as well. So that's an additional element that motivates me, but doesn't mean that I don't take cases that I don't agree with. But I do have both personal and professional reasons to take on this case.
In that case, just move on to the meat of our conversation, discussing the impact of the impending implementation of civil partnerships for same-sex couples. Could you quickly explain to us what exactly a civil partnership is for some of our listeners at home who might not know what it is?
Civil partnerships is sort of an institution which, even though it doesn't carry the name of a marriage, it gives the same or similar rights and obligations to couples. So one of the examples is in the UK under the Civil Partnerships Act, where civil partnerships are almost essentially the same as marriage, except the name of the institution. In some jurisdictions, the institution really arose because of the lack of marriage. So it's an alternative to marriage for same-sex couples. In some places, it's also an alternative for those people who, for example, cohabit, but don't want to marry. It's sort of basically an alternative form of relationship recognition, which is not marriage.
In my research, I came across some specific benefits that are given to it. So I saw that it includes rules for pensions, survivor benefits, annulments, and dissolutions are also very similar, although with specific differences. It also mentions that it allows for serious financial rights. Can you tell us a bit more about these financial rights?
It's a bit hard to say what the rights are because there's different kinds of partnership regimes around the world. Basic premise is to afford some kind of certainty in the arrangements between couples. Because at a certain point, having the legal recognition and having certain legal rights and obligations set in stone would help with the stability of that relationship. So some of it can be, for example, involving financial assets. What counts as financial assets which are shared among them? How to deal with financial assets when the relationship dissolves? The lack of these rules, for example, even in Hong Kong, when same-sex couples enter into marriages overseas, but they can't really get their relationship dissolved in Hong Kong, then that creates a lot of conflicts where there is no obvious solution. Like when they share a house, when they share a cat or a dog, who gets what? They become essentially locked into that kind of situation. But there are also other situations where having a recognized relationship would help. Sometimes because it determines legal rights, sometimes because it helps just in sort of telling people what to do. So for example, when you want to visit your partner in hospital, in Hong Kong, I think there isn't actually a piece of law which regulates who, but if you do have recognized relationship, then it helps to tell the doctors or nurses, like, why am I entitled to see them? Or for example, determining funeral arrangements, or for example, inheritance issues, basically so that people can really realize the extent to which they actually share a life and to actually have that relationship recognized and protected.
Thank you so much, Mr. Young. Shamsikit versus Secretary of Justice 2023 is the important case that we'll be mentioning in this section. So can you tell us a bit more about the background of this case?
The factual background is actually very straightforward. Essentially, it's an application for judicial review. The applicant is a gay man in Hong Kong. He's married to his husband in New York, but Hong Kong doesn't recognize same-sex marriages. So their marriage basically is not recognized in Hong Kong. So that's why he went to the courts and asked for either recognition of their marriage, or in the absence of that recognition, then at least some alternative form of relationship recognition, such as civil partnership arrangements. It might be worth mentioning that this is sort of a culmination of almost 20 years of litigation on LGBTQ rights in Hong Kong. We do in Hong Kong have a Bill of Rights which prohibit discrimination in similar terms as the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the ICCPR. But there were still a lot of inequalities on sexual orientation grounds. And most of it has been dealt with through the courts in a sort of an incremental approach. So for example, the first cases brought to courts about sexual orientation are about inequalities in criminal laws. So unequal age consent and so on. And then there started being cases about rights of same-sex couples. So Invinger is actually one of those cases about same-sex couples having rights to obtain public housing. There are other cases about the right to interstate inheritance. There are cases about dependent visas, cases about civil service benefits for spouses. There have been all these cases which have been decided again and again and going all the way up to the Court of Final Appeal, which is a top court in Hong Kong. And Shamsikit is basically the crown achievement at this stage.
Tuning back on our train of thought, could you tell us what was the important decision that arose from Shamsikit?
The applicant in Shamsikit, he lost in courts below. But at the Court of Final Appeal, he sort of won a partial victory. So as I just mentioned, basically there are two sets of issues. The first one is about same-sex marriage. So either a right to same-sex marriage under Hong Kong laws, or at least some kind of recognition for foreign same-sex marriage. So that concerns mainly the right to marry under the Hong Kong Basic Law. And then the second set of issues is about, okay, so short of marriage, if there's no marriage, then whether the government has to have some form of alternative framework to provide legal recognition to same-sex relationships. Essentially, the court was unanimous in rejecting the applicant's case in the first set of issues. So basically, all five members of the court, they agreed that there is no right to same-sex marriage in Hong Kong. And in ruling so, they actually followed, for example, some decisions of the UN Human Rights Committee and some other international and imperative cases and authorities. And on the second set of issues, the court, by a 3-2 majority, so basically 3 out of the 5 judges, they held in favor of the applicant, and they held that the absence of any framework to recognize same-sex relationships and to provide for their rights and obligations violates a number of constitutional rights, including the right to privacy and family. under the Constitution. And basically following that, the government now has an obligation to introduce some form of that alternative framework, which may be a civil partnership, it may be civil unions, or it may carry some other form of name, but the court didn't really prescribe what that framework has to be. What the court just did say is, well, you can't have nothing. So that's the extent of the decision.
Thank you so much for telling us that. In my own knowledge, when I was doing the research, it says that the ruling was suspended for 2 years so that the government has time to comply with that decision. Personally, I think a few of our audience would want to know what exactly does a suspension entail and why a suspension of 2 years?
So basically, because in this kind of proceedings, what the applicant can really obtain is a declaration. So basically, the court declares what the government has to do. But the courts, because they're courts, they're not policymakers. So they don't really go into details. They don't really tell the government, oh, when you enact this framework, it has to take this form, or you have to have these rights, and you must have these rights and must have what. So the court doesn't really go into detail. So they leave all those details to the government to flesh out. The court declared what the law is. So, and the law is that the government has to introduce some kind of framework. What it means by a suspension, it really just means that, oh, in the meantime, the absence of this framework doesn't render the government in contempt of court. It doesn't really suspend the state of the law, but it's just giving some time. So, okay, if you don't introduce it within 2 years, no one will hold you in contempt of court. No one would say that would have to imprison it. No one would have to be in jail for violating a court order. But that's a 2 year timeline that court gave the government.
So what happens if, let's say, by the 2 years, the government still has not proposed or enacted a bill that suggests an alternative framework? What then would the courts do?
That's a very interesting question because, okay, so to give some context, this actually happened before. So in a case called W, which is a 2003 and 2004, that was a case about the right of a trans person to marry in their experienced gender after having had sex reassignment surgeries. And in that case, the court held in favor and of the applicant and ruled that, oh, a trans woman who had already completed her surgeries, her sex reassignment surgeries at the time, will be able to marry as a woman. At that time, the court actually suspended the declaration and gave the government basically a year to introduce the relevant legislation to clarify this. But no such legislation was passed. And eventually, in that case, the court was able to say, okay, then absent such legislation, our ruling would just apply as case law. So it means that it would be binding. Like people who are in analogous situations to W in that case would be entitled to the same thing. So what it means is the decision did take legal effect, but there was not much certainty in the law as to anything that goes beyond it. Now, in this case, it's a bit difficult because if the government doesn't do anything, I'm not sure if there is anything in a judgment that can automatically take effect without relevant legislation. It's possible, for example, that someone will have to bring further proceedings to clarify that, to sort of force the government to do something. It's possible that it could also be followed up in the same proceedings and in the form of seeking some further form of relief. I'm not entirely sure. This is a bit of a speculation. But one can say that at least in past instances concerning same-sex couples, when the Court of Final Appeal ruled, for example, in a dependent visa case, the government did amend the dependent visa policy. And then when the Court of Final Appeal ruled against the government on certain taxation policies against same-sex couples, the government also did amend accordingly. So there is a record of compliance, but we will have to see because this is obviously more complicated than just amending a single document.
Let's actually continue with what you've already explained to us. Could you elaborate on why the Court of Final Appeal did not recognize a right to marriage for same-sex couples under the basic law? To clarify, for our audience at home, the Court of Final Appeal, as Mr. Young has said, is Hong Kong Supreme Court. And the basic law is essentially our constitution.
Basic law contains what is called the freedom of marriage. And similarly, the Bill of Rights in Hong Kong, it basically mirrors in language the ICCPR. So it contains a right to marry as well. And the court interpreted them together. Basically, the court was of the view that they mean the same thing. So the basic law, freedom of marriage, and the SCCPR right to marry, they mean the same thing. What this unfortunately brings about is that in the ICCPR jurisprudence, so the ICCPR is the body which is sort of tasked with the duty of interpreting and applying and monitoring the state's compliance with the ICCPR is something called the Human Rights Committee, which is a UN, sort of a UN body, as a treaty body under the United Nations. And it's a collective of independent experts. And they did hold in a 2003 case concerning New Zealand that under the ICCPR, there is no right to same-sex marriage. And it derived this because in the ICCPR, the right to marry does refer to the right of men and women of marriageable age to marry. And they argue that this is actually the only right which refers to men and women instead of the right of everyone. And it indicates that the right to marry under the ICCPR is confined to opposite sex marriage. And this has been followed. And in fact, actually, the same reasoning kind of applies in the cases of the European Court of Human Rights. So in the European Convention on Human Rights, there's also a right to marry. And the European Court of Human Rights has also consistently interpreted that right, so Article 12, as applying only to opposite sex couples. One can say that the Court of Final Appeal in Hong Kong basically followed or adopted the views of these international and regional bodies and applied them to the provisions that they are interpreting. There are also many other arguments. So for example, they argue that when the basic law was enacted, obviously the drafters only had in mind opposite sex marriage. Well, the basic law was enacted in 1990, but came into force in 1997. At that time, there was no same-sex marriage anywhere else. Obviously, the drafters of the Constitution didn't have in mind same-sex marriage. So all these arguments were deployed as well. Essentially, they reached an argument on, some might say, is it on relatively technical, legalistic grounds. They are not the only ones who have reached this conclusion. The European Court, the Human Rights Committee have reached similar conclusions. There are academic arguments that these decisions are wrong, but that's the state of the cases.
Moving on from the rationales behind denying the constitutional right to same-sex marriage in Hong Kong, what was the court's justification for recognizing an alternative framework for legal recognition of same-sex couples?
This also is not the first case in which sort of this kind of relief was granted. And very important example of where this was granted and which the Court of Final Appeal actually looked at is the European Court of Human Rights. So as I mentioned just now, the European Court of Human Rights, so far they have ruled that there's no same-sex marriage within the European Convention on Human Rights. But in a set of cases since about 2017, they have held that, well, in a case called Oliaria in Italy, so it involved Italy. The absence of any framework to provide legal recognition and to provide for the rights and obligations of same-sex couples violated their right to respect for their private and family life. So basically, the idea is, as I've mentioned just now, when couples share life together, they need recognition and they need legal rights and obligations in order to really realize that relationship and to live as a family. Otherwise, there are a lot of inconveniences. There are a lot of problems which will arise, both in formation, in dissolution, and in sort of in the going in the relationship going on. There will be a lot of difficulties, a lot of obstacles, and basically, the European Court sort of held that there's a what is called a positive obligation on the state. So the state has to do something to facilitate their enjoyment of family life as a same-sex couple and same-sex and families formed by same-sex couples. And it's a somewhat similar reasoning in the Hong Kong CFA, in the majority of the Hong Kong CFA as well. So basically, the idea is that same-sex couples need recognition and they need these rights and obligations in order to enjoy their family life. And the lack of these rights and obligations give rise to a lot of difficulties for them. So one of the examples that the courts, that the majority actually mentioned is the fact that these same-sex couples have to come to court repeatedly again and again in order to fight for their rights in various cases. And this, the court said, was an example of the arbitrary intrusion of this sort of state of affairs into their private life Like the fact that they have no rights and the fact that they have to undergo litigation and undergo all the publicity and the stress of the litigation in order to achieve again and again what the court said are basically their equal rights demonstrates the difficulties that the lack of a legal framework gives rise to in terms of their relationship.
With that in mind, we will be moving on to assessing some of the impacts of this case. Now, I'm assuming you've already actually mentioned some possible benefits given to same-sex couples by the framework of civil partnership. Can you tell us more specifics of having this framework? And what are some benefits that could give same-sex couples in Hong Kong?
As of now, we don't know what the framework will entail. From the CFA's judgment, it would seem at least that it has to contain the for example, set procedures for registering or forming these kind of unions or partnerships, procedures for dissolving these relationships so that people are not locked into de facto relationship they have. They have a way to go their separate lives if they want to. There are probably provisions about sharing properties and inheritance, but we don't know what other rights and obligations the government will actually want to accord to same-sex couples under this framework. One can possibly say that it is a culmination of a long line of LGBTQ rights litigation, but it probably is not the end. So if the framework, for example, doesn't give certain rights to same-sex couples, that can possibly be another issue for litigation as well. So just like the Infringer case, if the framework doesn't give same-sex couples the right to apply for public housing as a family, then possibly that would be a litigation issue as well. Or maybe because the court rules that same-sex couples ought to be able to apply to public housing on the same basis as opposite-sex couples, then the eventual framework will have to have that right. So it's still a bit of a developing area, and there's still a lot of uncertainty. And I honestly have no idea when we will see even a draft of the measure that will be proposed.
With some of these benefits in mind, what are some disadvantages of only providing civil partnership?
Well, one important issue is the fact that it is not marriage. And there are different ways to look at it. So some people, for example, think that the marriage is a very important institution. In fact, like some of the courts around the world, when they ruled in favor of same-sex marriage, they would think that, oh, actually, it's a good thing to extend marriage to more, so that more people can enjoy the institution of marriage. So, for example, the U.S. Supreme Court has said some things along these lines. But I think the more important point is equality, is the fact that there is an institution which is exclusively reserved for one class of people. And there's another class which simply, for some reason, cannot access. So sometimes the issue is framed less as a right to same-sex marriage, but more as an issue of marriage equality. So it's not about, oh, I really want to marry. So I may not want to marry, but I want to have the same right to do so. Because the state, in not treating people equally, basically is sending a message that they are unequal. And that message has the social impact as well. So that one is the symbolic and the message. And that's quite difficult. At least for now, the courts seem unwilling to give a same-sex marriage. So that may be an issue which only the government can remedy.
So we've already discussed a lot about how only providing civil partnership would perhaps reduce political or social legitimacy of same-sex marriage. In that case, can you tell us some of the benefits that this ruling would have on the social recognition of same-sex couples, or maybe even LGBTQ plus rights in Hong Kong?
Okay, I guess what I can say is that it provides a very good midpoint. I want to say starting point, but it's really not the starting point, but it provides a very good reference point. Society as a whole, and also inside the courtrooms, we can discuss equality for same-sex couples, provide sort of a reference point for everyone. And a reference point is that, well, same-sex couples, their relationships deserve recognition and they need certain rights. We can go on to discuss what rights and the specifics, but at least we have a common ground. As a matter of constitutional principles, as a matter of human dignity and human rights.
With all these implications and impacts in mind, I would like to move on to the second section of today's episode and discuss some of the other protections that are already currently afforded same-sex couples in Hong Kong. So aside from the impending civil partnership framework, could you just quickly point out some other general protections that are afforded to same-sex couples and what aren't?
It's hard to say what aren't
What aren't?
protected. It's easier to list out what are
What are?
protected.
I see.
So basically, fundamentally, as I mentioned just now, we have a Bill of Rights which prohibits the government from discriminating on sexual orientation grounds, but there's no anti-discrimination law for private bodies. So there's still no protection for LGBTQ people, for example, in the workplace or in schools. And the lack of that of anti-discrimination legislation for LGBTQ people has been sort of like a sore point in Hong Kong law. In terms of government policies, as I mentioned, there has been like a series of litigation over this. And it started at first, we no longer have the prohibition of homosexuality. So, like, for example, sodomy offense in some in many other former British colonies. So we don't have that. That was actually repealed by the legislature in 1991. We still inherited like a set of inequalities in the criminal law. So for example, until 2005, the age of consent for heterosexual sexual intercourse was 16, but the age of consent for what was then called so-called buggery, so for example, anal intercourse, was 21, and that was sort of struck down in 2005 through judicial review, through the courts. The courts basically declared that the age of consent for everyone should be 16, and there shouldn't be differential treatment for straight and gay people. And then there are also a bunch of other criminal offenses which only applied to gay people but didn't apply to heterosexual conduct. And those were also struck down or remedied through the courts in the last few years. Apart from that, there was a case about dependent visa. Again, it was through the courts. Same-sex couples can apply for dependent visas as heterosexual married couples can. There's also another case, also through the courts, about civil servants. The same-sex partners of civil servants can enjoy the same spousal benefits as heterosexual couples. And also, same-sex couples can file for joint tax assessment. So basically, some kind of tax policies which used to only apply again to opposite sex married couples. Now they also apply to same-sex couples. And then there are also a series of litigation which haven't yet reached the court final appeal, but so far we have won in lower courts our public housing, as you've mentioned in the Infinger case. There's another form of housing called subsidized housing. That was also a target of a challenge, which succeeded. And then there are also intestate inheritance rules. That was legislation which used to only, so for example, if someone died without leaving a will, so his married spouse would be able to get some form of inheritance under the law. But that didn't apply to same-sex couples. And then again, there was a target of challenge which was won. And then there are many other areas, so which consistently, I think there was actually a report which was commissioned by the Equal Opportunities Commission a few years ago, and it identified over like hundreds of provisions in laws and policies which
Jesus.
differentiate treatment for
I
same-sex
see.
couples. And either we have to sue on them one by one, as we have done, or hopefully the upcoming framework for civil partnership would actually deal with some of them.
So, with these hundreds of possible cases at hand, can you tell us about two specific cases that has already been passed, especially specifically the background for Infinger Nick v. the Hong Kong Housing Authority?
So the Infinger and Hong Kong Housing Authority case. So because I wasn't, I'm involved in that case, so I will restrict myself to just mentioning the facts. So as Anson mentioned, that this involves something called the public rental housing, which is a very scarce resource in Hong Kong. Like a lot of people in Hong Kong live in this form of public housing, and which is distributed by an authority called the Hong Kong Housing Authority. And there are basically there are two queues, two lines for these applications. One involves, for example, families, elderlies, and so on. And that line has different rules. The other line for it is what is called single non-elderly applicants. So basically single applicants who are, say, below the age of 60. And they have significantly different rules. And as a matter of fact, they have very different waiting times. So for example, a 20-year-old single man, if he applies under the single elderly, non-elderly applicant route, basically he can expect to wait 20, like 10, 20, or 30 years. If you can apply as a family, one, you get a family flat, so you get to live with your family, and two, as a matter of fact, your waiting time is likely to be fewer, which probably still means several years because of the scarcity of the resource. But the difference is quite stark. And because the housing authority, they have their own policy on what counts as a family, and in their own policy, spouses, so heterosexual married spouses count as a family, but same-sex couples don't because they can't be married in Hong Kong. And that gives rise to a difference in treatment. So same-sex couples under the policy as interpreted by the housing authority can never apply as a family, which means one, they wait much longer. Two, even if they apply separately, they can't live together. Basically, that's the factual background of challenge. And so far, we've won in the court final first instance. We've won in the court of appeal, but leave was just granted for the housing authority to appeal further to the court of final appeal.
What exactly was the ruling for Infinternic? Can you explain to us very shortly?
So basically, what the court said was the complete exclusion of same-sex couples from the policy is discriminatory and is not justified. So, and there's no reasonable justification for that exclusion. It doesn't mean that same-sex couples must be regarded as married. It doesn't necessarily even mean that same-sex couples must be called a family, but they shouldn't be completely excluded and treated categorically differently as opposite-sex married couples. So basically what it means is that, for example, if we do eventually win, one would think that the housing authority would have to revise their policy and to treat same-sex couples equally as heterosexual married couples. But as to like the specifics of that, the details of that, it's hard to speculate at this stage. Yeah. So for example, when the government lost the dependent visa case, it was a similar basis of ruling. That the government eventually amended the policy on dependent visas to include, in exact terms, in quotation marks, same-sex marriages. So they still like refuse to call it an actual marriage, but they have to treat them in the same way as married couples.
I see.
Married spouses. So they may not necessarily have to call them spouses or call them married, but as a matter of substance, the treatment has to be equal.
So substantially, the government has to treat them equal, as to treat a same-sex couples equally, but in name, they will do so differently.
Yeah, they may not give them the name of a spouse. It's possible. So, and this sort of has been a basis of this series of litigation, is that we are arguing about they should enjoy substantive rights on an equal basis. Whatever name you give them, we can leave that for future debate, but as a matter of substantive rights, they should enjoy the same rights.
Why does the government insist on appealing every single time and drag its feet in implementing court decisions when they lose in lower courts and appeal constantly?
Very hard to really answer that question because I don't know. As a matter of law, because in every case we're talking about equality, in every case we're talking about whether the differential treatment is justified on a proportionality analysis. So what it means is a proportionality analysis is basically you assess whether the differential treatment pursues a legitimate aim, whether it is rationally connected to the aim, whether it is no more than necessary to achieve that aim, whether it achieves a fair balance between the rights and the and this interest achieved by it, and so on. So, and this kind of analysis basically in seeing whether, because not every differential treatment is discrimination. There are differential treatments which obviously are reasonable and you probably wouldn't call it discrimination. For example, allowing people over the age of 65 some priority in public housing is probably very much justified. So even though it's differential treatment, it's probably justified, in which case you wouldn't necessarily call it discrimination. Or think that it should be unlawful. So, and it's a similar point. As a matter of law, you can say that in every different context, the considerations could be different. So the analysis in the terms of dependent visas and an analysis in terms of, for example, scarce public resources such as housing, they could be different. The aims of the differential treatment could be different. So legally, you can't say that, because same-sex couples have one right, they must have all the other rights. So you can say that there's room. And obviously, the Court of Appeal having granted leave to appeal, obviously, they think it's reasonably arguable. But as to why they are insisting so much on fighting this, it's hard to say. I mean, why do they not just take the Shamsiki judgment and just propose a civil partnership framework and just avoid all these future litigation? Why don't they do that? They probably have their own policy on what they think are protecting so-called traditional institutional marriage, which is what they often talk about in courts and in their press releases. They have their policy views on this. But yeah, it's hard to speculate why the government insists on appealing.
I do think it's important to mention the case of Leung T.C. William Roy v. Secretary of Justice. Could you explain in extremely short terms what the background and very quickly what the ruling was?
So William Leung case, it's like sort of the first case in Hong Kong about sexual orientation discrimination. And it's sort of that is exactly the case about unequal age of consent for same sex and different sex sexual conduct. And it was basically the first case, which was about discrimination on sexual orientation grounds. They confirmed that the government can't discriminate on sexual orientation grounds. It sort of laid down the first principles for determining cases like this. And eventually it struck down. It recognized that the unequal age of consent is discriminatory against gay people, and there was no justification for that differential treatment. And the court held that there should be equal age of consent. And there are a number of other issues which were quite important, but they were very legal technicality issues. But those issues are quite important. So, for example, the procedural standing of the applicant to challenge a law like this has actually informed some other jurisdictions on their approach as well. So, yeah, but fundamentally, it's about unequal age of consent. And it's the first case in Hong Kong about LGBT rights confirming sort of some of the fundamental principles on which cases of sexual orientation discrimination should be approached.
Thank you very much, Mr. Young. We're going to be moving on very quickly into our final section on solutions and future developments to remedy the incomplete protection of same-sex and LGBTQ+ rights in Hong Kong. So the first of our last batch of questions is, with the previous discussion focused mainly on the same-sex couples, what are the rights given to transgender or queer individuals in Hong Kong, and what are some of their limitations?
So trans rights is very much under development in Hong Kong. So in a way similar to same-sex couples, there have been cases which are progressing through the courts on trans rights. So for example, one of the first important cases is, as I mentioned previously, is the W case, which is about the right of, in the court's terminology, post-operative trans women, which means women who have completed sex reassignment surgeries, to marry as a woman. And basically the CFA ruled by a 4-1 majority. Women in that position should be able to do so. But in that judgment, actually, quite importantly, the CFA commented quite significantly on the lack of legislation to deal with the recognition of trans people's gender identities. And it referred, for example, to the existence of such a legislation in the UK. So so in the UK, it's the Gender Recognition Act, which provides for example, criteria on when trans people could be recognized in their gender identity, the procedures for doing so, the implications in other laws and regulations, and so on. So unfortunately, we still don't have that legislation. Despite the CFA having commented on a need for such legislation, we still don't have any such legislation. And there's some work by the government to sort of consult on this, but it's been over 8 years and we haven't seen any concrete proposal yet, which is quite disappointing. So as a result, it's still left to the courts to decide on a case, in cases. So for example, there have been cases about trans prisoners. There have been cases about trans people and their gender on their Hong Kong ID cards. So Hong Kong ID cards is basically an identity document which everyone has to carry in Hong Kong. And it's very
sorry,
often
just to interrupt. Would that be the Tse Henry Edward case?
Yes, that's the Tse Henry Edward case. It eventually reached the Court of Final Appeal, which is very helpful because it followed very recent developments in the European jurisprudence. In holding that, the applicants in that case, basically, they were trans people, but they haven't done or they haven't done all of the sex reassignment surgeries. So for example, they may have done some of the surgeries, they may have done none of the surgeries, but only had hormonal treatment. They may have received a gender recognition certificate in the UK, for example. But the Hong Kong ID, the government's policy for Hong Kong IDs was that only those who had completed so-called full sex reassignment surgeries could have their gender changed on the Hong Kong ID, which means these trans people who haven't done so were not able to change the Hong Kong ID. And this had a huge implication because Hong Kong IDs are quite widely used in Hong Kong. For example, when you find a job, they will ask for a copy of the Hong Kong ID. On the streets, police officers could ask for Hong Kong IDs. Entering Hong Kong, immigration, you have to use your Hong Kong IDs. And when your Hong Kong ID doesn't accord with your gender identity, it leads to huge difficulties. And it also often has a very serious impact on the mental health of those affected as well. And in this Henry Edward case, the court of final appeal held that the requirement of sex reassignment surgery is for changing the gender on Hong Kong ID violated the rights of these applicants. So essentially, again, what does that mean? What is now the criteria? Again, that's kind of left to the government, but at least it can't close off. It can't draw the line at this, at the line of surgery. It can't say that, oh, anyone who doesn't have surgery cannot change. So it can't draw the line at this. But basically, it's the line has been moving, but it's mainly through the courts. And so far there hasn't been like a consistent legislation to deal with it.
I see. Yeah. So how adequate would you think that the Hong Kong's legal system is in protecting the rights of same-sex couples and the rest of the LGBTQ plus community?
It's patchy because most of it is a result of litigation. And because litigation, almost necessarily, they're concerned with like specific laws or policies or specific issues. So it's been patchy. When if a same-sex couple comes to Hong Kong, they want to know what rights they have, I can't produce a piece of legislation and tell them like these are the rights that you have. I can only tell them, oh, in this case, you have this right. In this case, you have this right. So it's very patchy. There's not much certainty. In cases where there's been no court case, you will have to sort of seek legal advice. And it creates a lot of uncertainties. Now, hopefully, with the Sham Sea Kid case, and when the government implements that decision, we'll have greater certainty. But it's still possible that some gray areas will still have to depend on litigation. So basically, it's patchy. It's hopefully there will be greater certainty, but it's not great. But right. it is of course better than many in places where it's criminal to even criminal to be gay. But so we're not in that stage. But equally, if you ask me what rights same-sex couples have, it will require a very long answer.
I can't give you
a very certain or straightforward answer.
I see. So with the current state of Hong Kong's recognition of LGBTQ rights, if we look at other countries as potential models, what are some possible future policies that we can remedy and continue to improve on our current system?
I mean, there are a lot of policy concerns that LGBTQ people have. I guess the main one would be one, anti-discrimination legislation to protect LGBTQ people from discrimination in the workplace, in schools, in goods and services, and so on. Many other countries have such legislation. UK have such legislation. The second would be the relationship recognition. So civil partnership, marriage, basically recognition of same-sex couples. And that's been, we're waiting for progress. We've made some progress, but hopefully there will be more. The third is trans rights. So a lot of it has to deal with when should the law recognize a person as having changed his gender in the legal sense. and we don't have any legislation on that. Again, the UK has Gender Recognition Act, which we don't have. Even though the Gender Recognition Act is subject to a lot of criticisms, because it was over 10 years ago, so people want to improve it and so on, but we don't even have any of that. So that's another important thing as well. And there are many other like policy measures as well. So in the education, how is sexuality and sexual orientation and gender identity taught in schools? There are issues about intersex children and how they are treated as well. Of course, there are also issues with basically whether you need to have gender markers on identity documents at all. Some people would think that you don't actually need any gender markers on many identity documents. And that may be relevant to, for example, non-binary and queer individuals as well. So there are a lot of small other measures which are needed. But I think the main difficulty we have is that we, so far, most of the progress we have made is through courts. And that necessarily is not very consistent, and it would lead to patchy laws and regulations, and it's not very desirable. Of course, it would be better if the government takes a more proactive role in doing that. And the court has called upon the government to be more proactive in reviewing their laws and regulations rather than just leaving it to cases. But so far, we haven't seen that.
I see. So to wrap up this last episode, for some of our concluding questions, as law students, where can we learn more about these legal challenges faced by LGBTQ plus community in Hong Kong?
This podcast.
And thank you.
And there are many other ways. So in newspapers, often, because one good thing about judicial review is that it's very often reported in the news in Hong Kong. So it's sort of like a guarantee of publicity. So you can read the decisions, you can learn about the decisions through newspapers quite easily. Very often they're reported in the news. And then as law students, you can then go on to find the judgments if you're interested and to read them. And the judgments are all freely available online, either on the judiciary website or the HKLII, which is similar to Bailey. Occasionally, you also have seminars and talks and conferences. So LGBTQ rights is one of the good things about LGBTQ rights is that it's quite commonly discussed in many, for example, conferences, panels, seminars, and Hong Kong sometimes do come up as well. So look out for seminars or conferences on this topic and events on this topic, or talk to people who are interested in this.
I see. The last question of this episode. So what are some necessary ingredients to become a successful barrister in public law in Hong Kong, or just a successful barrister in general?
Okay, I can't really claim to say that I know the secrets, because I know I probably would have done even better. I guess what I learned from people who I do think are successful barristers and successful barristers in public law, what I learned from them is, one, you do need passion for the work, not necessarily passion for the cause. That's quite different. But it's passion for the work that you're doing, for the advocacy, for the legal challenges, the legalities and the cases and advocacy. So you have to have passion for doing that work, because you need that to sustain your will to attain excellence, because this is a very competitive field. A lot of people are interested in public law, but not a lot of people actually end up doing public law, because it's a very small field. In any jurisdiction, it's a relatively small field. It's definitely like a smaller field and more competitive. It's definitely a smaller field than, for example, general civil work. So you need to have passion to drive you. You need to be analytical and objective about this. So, and there are different schools in this. Some people believe that you're better lawyers when you believe in the cause. Some people believe that you're better lawyers when you can be objective. I think you need to find somewhere in between. So for example, whatever I believe in the cause, I would hope that at least on an objective critical analysis, I can persuade myself that this argument is correct as a matter of law. So it's hard because it's sort of like a constant learning as well, which is quite interesting. You can't just say, oh, just the danger is that you have blind spots because you believe in the cause. You have blind spots in your analysis, and you fail to see the arguments of the other side, and that actually does a disservice to your cause. So, how to sort of maintain that critical this objectivity while still having passion for what you're doing is quite important. And well, finally, hard work. It is a lot of work, and often it's not just about the law. It's also about crafting the, looking at the evidence. It's all about preparing the evidence and thinking about the case. So it's not just you can't just be good at the law. You still have there are many other aspects to advocacy as well, which you have to master, and that requires a lot of hard work, especially for junior barristers. And it's a very steep learning curve. But if you have passion, which is the first criteria, you should be able to overcome a steep learning curve. At least you enjoy the process of that. And those are basically what I'm trying to the characteristics that I'm trying to achieve. As far as I've observed from people who I think are really good at this.
Thank you so much for speaking on our episode. It's been a wonderful time, and I'm sure our audience has learned a lot from this episode. Thank you for attending.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for inviting.
Thank you so much.